Chapter 41. The stitches in Langdon's scalp were throbbing again as he and Sienna squeezed inside the video control room with Marta and the two guards. The cramped space was nothing more than a converted vestment chamber with a bank of whirring hard drives and computer monitors. The air inside was stiflingly hot and smelled of stale cigarette smoke. Langdon felt the walls closing in around him immediately. Marta took a seat in front of the video monitor, which was already in playback mode and displayed a grainy black-and-white image of the Andito, shot from above the door. The timestamp on screen indicated that the footage had been queued to mid-morning yesterday, precisely 24 hours ago, apparently just before the museum opened and long before the arrival of Langdon and the mysterious Il Duomino that evening. The guard fast-forwarded through the video, and Langdon watched as an influx of tourists flowed rapidly into the Andito, moving in hurried, jerky motions. The mask itself was not visible from this perspective, but clearly it was still in its display case as tourists repeatedly paused to peer inside or take photos before moving on. "Please hurry," Langdon thought, knowing the police were on their way. He wondered if he and Sienna should just excuse themselves and run, but they needed to see this video. Whatever was on this recording would answer a lot of questions about what the hell was going on. The video playback continued, faster now, and afternoon shadows began moving across the room. Tourists zipped in and out until finally the crowds began to thin and then abruptly disappeared entirely. As the timestamp raced past 1700 hours, the museum lights went out, and all was quiet. 5 p.m. Closing time.
"Aumenti la velocità,"
Marta commanded, leaning forward in her chair and staring at the screen. The guard let the video race on, the timestamp advancing quickly until suddenly, at around 10 p.m., the lights in the museum flickered back on. The guard quickly slowed the tape back to regular speed. A moment later, the familiar pregnant shape of Marta Alvarez came into view. She was followed closely by Langdon, who entered wearing his familiar Harris tweed Camberley jacket, pressed khakis, and his own Cordovan loafers. He even saw the glint of his Mickey Mouse watch peeking out from under his sleeve as he walked.
"There I am, before I got shot."
Langdon found it deeply unsettling to watch himself doing things of which he had absolutely no recollection.
"I was here last night looking at the death mask?"
Somehow, between then and now, he had managed to lose his clothing, his Mickey Mouse watch, and 2 days of his life. As the video continued, he and Sienna crowded in close behind Marta and the guards for a better view. The silent footage continued, showing Langdon and Marta arriving at the display case and admiring the mask. As they were doing this, a broad shadow darkened the doorway behind him, and a morbidly obese man shuffled into the frame. He was dressed in a tan suit, carried a briefcase, and barely fit through the door. His bulging gut made even the pregnant Marta look slender. Langdon recognized the man at once.
"Ignazio?"
"That's Ignazio Busoni," Langdon whispered in Sienna's ear. "Director of the Museo dell'Opera del Duomo. An acquaintance of mine for several years. I'd just never heard him called Il Duomino."
"A fitting epithet,"
Sienna replied quietly. In years past, Langdon had consulted Ignazio on artifacts and history relating to Il Duomo, the basilica for which he was responsible. But a visit to the Palazzo Vecchio seemed outside Ignazio's domain. Then again, Ignazio Busoni, in addition to being an influential figure in the Florentine art world, was a Dante enthusiast and scholar. A logical source of information on Dante's death mask. As Langdon returned his focus to the video, Marta could now be seen waiting patiently against the rear wall of the Andito, while Langdon and Ignazio leaned out over the stanchions to get the closest possible look at the mask. As the men continued their examination and discussion, the minutes wore on, and Marta could be seen discreetly checking her watch behind their backs. Langdon wished the security tape included audio.
What were Ignazio and I talking about? What are we looking for?
Just then, on screen, Langdon stepped over the stanchions and crouched down directly in front of the cabinet, his face only inches from the glass. Marta immediately intervened, apparently admonishing him, and Langdon apologetically stepped back.
Sorry I was so strict, Marta now said, glancing back at him over her shoulder. But as I told you, the display case is an antique and extremely fragile. The mask's owner insists we keep people behind the stanchions. He won't even permit our staff to open the case without him present.
Her words took a moment to register. The mask's owner? Langdon had assumed the mask was the property of the museum. Sienna looked equally surprised and chimed in immediately.
The museum doesn't own the mask?
Marta shook her head, her eyes now back on the screen.
A wealthy patron offered to buy Dante's death mask from our collection and yet leave it on permanent display here. He offered a small fortune, and we happily accepted.
Hold on, Sienna said. He paid for the mask and let you keep it? Common arrangement, Langdon said. Philanthropic acquisition. A way for donors to make major grants to museums without registering the gift as charity.
The donor was an unusual man, Marta said. A genuine scholar of Dante, and yet a bit, how do you say, fanatical.
Who is he? Sienna demanded, her casual tone laced with urgency.
Who?
Marta frowned, still staring at the screen.
Well, you probably read about him in the news recently. The Swiss billionaire, Bertrand Zobrist.
For Langdon, the name seemed only vaguely familiar, but Sienna grabbed Langdon's arm and squeezed it hard, looking as if she'd seen a ghost.
Oh, yes,
Sienna said haltingly, her face ashen.
Bertrand Zobrist, famous biochemist, made a fortune in biological patents at a young age.
She paused, swallowing hard. She leaned over and whispered to Langdon.
Zobrist basically invented the field of germline manipulation.
Langdon had no idea what germline manipulation was, but it had an ominous ring, especially in light of the recent spate of images involving plagues and death. He wondered if Sienna knew so much about Zobrist because she was well-read in the field of medicine, or perhaps because they had both been child prodigies. Do savants follow each other's work?
I first heard of Zobrist a few years ago, Sienna explained, when he made some highly provocative declarations in the media about population growth.
She paused, her face gloomy.
Zobrist is a proponent of the population apocalypse equation.
I beg your pardon?
Essentially, it's a mathematical recognition that the Earth's population is rising, people are living longer, and our natural resources are waning. The equation predicts that the current trend can have no outcome other than the apocalyptic collapse of society. Zobrist has publicly predicted that the human race will not survive another century, unless we have some kind of mass extinction event.
Sienna sighed heavily and locked eyes with Langdon.
In fact, Zobrist was once quoted as saying that the best thing that ever happened to Europe was the Black Death.
Langdon stared at her in shock. The hair on his neck bristled as, once again, the image of the plague mask flashed through his mind. He had been trying all morning to resist the notion that his current dilemma related to a deadly plague, but that notion was getting more and more difficult to refute. For Bertrand Zobrist to describe the Black Death as the best thing ever to happen to Europe was certainly appalling. And yet Langdon knew that many historians had chronicled the long-term socio-economic benefits of the mass extinction that had occurred in Europe in the 1300s. Prior to the plague, overpopulation, famine, and economic hardship had defined the Dark Ages. The sudden arrival of the Black Death, while horrific, had effectively thinned the human herd, creating an abundance of food and opportunity, which, according to many historians, had been a primary catalyst for bringing about the Renaissance. As Langdon pictured the biohazard symbol on the tube that had contained the modified map of Dante's Inferno, a chilling thought struck him. The eerie little projector had been created by someone. And Bertrand Zobrist, a biochemist and Dante fanatic, now seemed to be a logical candidate. The father of genetic germline manipulation. Langdon sensed pieces of the puzzle now falling into place. Regrettably, the picture coming into focus felt increasingly frightening.
Fast forward through this part,
Marta ordered the guard, sounding eager to get past the real-time playback of Langdon and Ignazio Busoni studying the mask so she could find out who had broken into the museum and stolen it. The guard hit the fast-forward button, and the timestamp accelerated. 3 minutes, 6 minutes, 8 minutes. On screen, Marta could be seen standing behind the men, shifting her weight with increasing frequency and repeatedly checking her watch. "I'm sorry we talked so long," Langdon said. "You look uncomfortable."
"My own fault," Marta replied. "You both insisted that I should go home and the guards could let you out, but I felt that would be rude."
Suddenly, on screen, Marta disappeared. The guard slowed the video to normal speed.
"It's okay," Marta said. "I remember going to the restroom."
The guard nodded and reached again for the fast-forward button. But before he pressed it, Marta grabbed his arm.
"Aspetti."
She cocked her head and stared at the monitor in confusion. Langdon had seen it too. What in the world? On screen, Langdon had just reached into the pocket of his tweed coat and produced a pair of surgical gloves, which he was now pulling onto his hands. Simultaneously, Il Duomino positioned himself behind Langdon, peering down the hallway where Marta had moments earlier trudged off to use the restroom. After a moment, the obese man nodded to Langdon in a way that seemed to mean that the coast was clear.
"What the hell are we doing?"
Langdon watched himself on the video as his gloved hand reached out and found the edge of the cabinet door, and then, ever so gently, pulled back until the antique hinge shifted and the door swung slowly open, exposing the Dante death mask. Marta Alvarez let out a horrified gasp and brought her hands to her face. Sharing Marta's horror, Langdon watched himself in utter disbelief as he reached into the case, gently gripped the Dante death mask with both hands, and lifted it out.
"Dio mi salvi!"
Marta exploded, heaving herself to her feet and spinning around to face Langdon.
"Cosa fatto? Perché?"
Before Langdon could respond, one of the guards whipped out a black Beretta and aimed it directly at Langdon's chest.
"Jesus!"
Robert Langdon stared down the barrel of the guard's handgun and felt the tiny room closing in around him. Marta Alvarez was on her feet now, glaring up at him with an incredulous look of betrayal on her face. On the security monitor behind her, Langdon was now holding the mask up to the light and studying it.
"I took it out only for a moment,"
Langdon insisted, praying that this was true.
"Ignazio assured me you wouldn't mind."
Marta did not reply. She looked stupefied, clearly trying to imagine why Langdon had lied to her, and indeed how in the world Langdon could have calmly stood by and let the tape play when he knew what it would reveal.
"I had no idea I opened the case." "Robert," Sienna whispered, "look, you found something."
Sienna remained riveted on the playback, focusing on getting answers despite their predicament. On screen, Langdon was now holding the mask up and angling it toward the light, his attention apparently drawn to something of interest on the back of the artifact. From this camera angle, for a split second, the raised mask partially blocked Langdon's face in such a way that Dante's dead eyes were aligned with Langdon's. He remembered the pronouncement. "The truth can be glimpsed only through the eyes of death," and felt a chill. Langdon had no idea what he might have been examining on the back of the mask, but at that moment in the video, as he shared his discovery with Ignazio, the obese man recoiled, immediately fumbling for his spectacles and looking again and again. He began shaking his head vigorously and pacing the andito in an agitated state. Suddenly both men glanced up, clearly having heard something in the hallway. Most likely Marta returning from the restroom. Hurriedly, Langdon pulled from his pocket a large Ziploc bag, into which he sealed the death mask before gently handing it to Ignacio, who placed it, with seeming reluctance, inside his briefcase. Langdon quickly closed the antique glass door on the now empty display case, and the two men strode briskly up the hall to encounter Marta before she could discover their theft. Both guards now had their guns trained on Langdon. Marta wobbled on her feet, grasping the table for support.
"I don't understand," she sputtered. "You and Ignacio Busoni stole the Dante death mask?"
"No," Langdon insisted, bluffing as best as he could. "We had permission from the owner to take the mask out of the building for the night."
"Permission from the owner?" she questioned. "From Bertrand Zobrist?"
"Yes. Mr. Zobrist agreed to let us examine some markings on the back. We met with him yesterday afternoon." Marta's eyes shot daggers.
"Professor, I am quite certain you did not meet with Bertrand Zobrist yesterday afternoon."
"We most certainly did." Sienna placed a restraining hand on Langdon's arm.
"Robert,"
she gave a grim sigh,
"6 days ago, Bertrand Zobrist threw himself off the top of the Badia Tower, only a few blocks away from here."
Chapter 42. Vianza had abandoned her motorcycle just north of the Palazzo Vecchio and was approaching on foot along the perimeter of the Piazza della Signoria. As she wound her way through the Loggia de Lanzi's outdoor statuary, she could not help but notice that all the figures seemed to be enacting a variation on a single theme: violent displays of male dominance over women. The rape of the Sabines, the rape of Polyxena, Perseus holding the severed head of Medusa. "Lovely," Vianza thought, pulling her cap low over her eyes and edging her way through the morning crowd toward the entrance of the palace, which was just admitting the first tourists of the day. From all appearances, it was business as usual here at the Palazzo Vecchio.
"No police," Vianza thought. "At least not yet."
She zipped her jacket high around her neck, making certain that her weapon was concealed, and headed through the entrance. Following signs for Il Museo di Palazzo, she passed through two ornate atriums and then up a massive staircase toward the second floor. As she climbed, she replayed the police dispatch in her head.
"Il Museo di Palazzo Vecchio. Dante Alighieri. Langdon has to be here."
The signs for the museum led Vianza into a massive, spectacularly adorned gallery, the Hall of the 500, where a scattering of tourists mingled, admiring the colossal murals on the walls. Vianza had no interest in observing the art here and quickly located another museum sign in the far right-hand corner of the room, pointing up a staircase. As she made her way across the hall, she noticed a group of university kids all gathered around a single sculpture, laughing and taking pictures. The plaque read, "Hercules and Diomedes." Vianza eyed the statues and groaned. The sculpture depicted the two heroes of Greek mythology, both stark naked, locked in a wrestling match. Hercules was holding Diomedes upside down, preparing to throw him, while Diomedes was tightly gripping Hercules' penis, as if to say, "Are you sure you want to throw me?" Vianza winced.
"Talk about having someone by the balls."
She removed her eyes from the peculiar statue and quickly climbed the stairs toward the museum. She arrived on a high balcony that overlooked the hall. A dozen or so tourists were waiting outside the museum entrance. "Delayed opening," one cheerful tourist offered, peeking out from behind his camcorder.
"Any idea why?" she asked.
"Nope, but what a great view while we wait." The man swung his arm out over the expanse of the Hall of the 500 below. Vianza walked to the edge and peered at the expansive room beneath them. Downstairs, a lone police officer was just arriving, drawing very little attention as he moved, without any sense of urgency, across the room toward the staircase.
"He's coming up to take a statement," Vianza imagined.
The man's lugubrious trudge up the stairs indicated this was a routine response call, nothing like the chaotic search for Langdon at the Porta Romana.
"If Langdon is here, why aren't they swarming the building?"
Either Vianza had assumed incorrectly that Langdon was here, or the local police and Bruder had not yet put two and two together. As the officer reached the top of the stairs and ambled toward the museum entrance, Bayantha casually turned away and pretended to gaze out a window. Considering her disavowal and the long reach of the provost, she was not taking any chances of being recognized.
Aspetta!
A voice shouted somewhere. Bayantha's heart skipped a beat as the officer stopped directly behind her. The voice, she realized, was coming from his walkie-talkie.
Attende rinforzi,
the voice repeated.
Wait for support?
Bayantha sensed that something had just changed. Just then, outside the window, Bayantha noticed a black object growing larger in the distant sky. It was flying toward the Palazzo Vecchio from the direction of the Boboli Gardens.
The drone,
Bayantha realized.
Bruder knows, and he's headed this way.
Consortium facilitator Lawrence Knowlton was still kicking himself for phoning the provost. He knew better than to suggest that the provost preview the client's video before it was uploaded to the media tomorrow. The content was irrelevant. Protocol is king. Knowlton still recalled the mantra taught to young facilitators when they started handling tasks for the organization. Don't ask, just task. Reluctantly, he placed the little red memory stick in the queue for tomorrow morning, wondering what the media would make of the bizarre message. Would they even play it? Of course they will. It's from Bertrand Zobrist. Not only was Zobrist a staggeringly successful figure in the biomedical world, but he was already in the news as a result of his suicide last week. This 9-minute video would play like a message from the grave, and its ominously macabre quality would make it nearly impossible for people to turn it off. This video will go viral within minutes of its release. Chapter 43. Marta Alvarez was seething as she stepped out of the cramped video room, having left Langdon and his rude little sister at gunpoint with the guards. She marched over to a window and peered down at the Piazza della Signoria, relieved to see a police car parked out front.
It's about time.
Marta still could not fathom why a man as respected in his profession as Robert Langdon would so blatantly deceive her, take advantage of the professional courtesy she had offered, and steal a priceless artifact.
And Ignazio Busoni assisted him. Unthinkable.
Intent on giving Ignazio a piece of her mind, Marta pulled out her cell phone and dialed Il Duomino's office, which was several blocks away at the Museo dell'Opera del Duomo. The line rang only once.
Ufficio di Ignazio Busoni?
A familiar woman's voice answered. Marta was friendly with Ignazio's secretary, but was in no mood for small talk.
Eugenio, sono Marta. Devo parlare con Ignazio.
There was an odd pause on the line, and then suddenly the secretary burst into hysterical sobbing.
Cosa succede?
Marta demanded. What's wrong?
Eugenia tearfully told Marta that she had just arrived at the office to learn that Ignazio had suffered a massive heart attack last night in an alleyway near the Duomo.
It was around midnight when he had called for an ambulance, but the medics hadn't arrived in time. Busoni was dead. Marta's legs nearly buckled beneath her. This morning she'd heard on the news that an unnamed city official had died the previous night, but she never imagined it was Ignazio.
Eugenia, ascoltami,
Marta urged, trying to remain calm as she quickly explained what she had just witnessed on the Palazzo video cameras, the Dante death mask stolen by Ignazio and Robert Langdon, who was now being held at gunpoint. Marta had no idea what response she expected Eugenia to make, but it most certainly was not what she heard.
Roberto Langdon?
Eugenia demanded.
Sei con Langdon ora?
You're with Langdon now? Eugenia seemed to be missing the point.
Yes, but the mask. Devo parlare con lui.
Eugenia all but shouted. I need to speak to him. Inside the security room, Langdon's head continued to throb as the guards aimed their weapons directly at him. Abruptly, the door opened, and Marta Alvarez appeared. Through the open door, Langdon heard the distant whine of the drone somewhere outside, its ominous buzz accompanied by the wail of approaching sirens. They found out where we are.
È arrivata la polizia,
Marta told the guards, sending one of them out to usher the authorities into the museum. The other remained behind, gun barrel still aimed at Langdon. To Langdon's surprise, Marta held out a cell phone to him.
"Someone wants to speak to you," she said, sounding mystified. "You'll need to take it out here to have a connection."
The group migrated from the stuffy control room into the gallery space just outside, where sunlight poured through large windows offering a spectacular view of Piazza della Signoria below. Although he was still at gunpoint, Langdon felt relieved to be out of the enclosed space. Marta motioned him over near the window and handed him the phone. Langdon took it, uncertain, and raised it to his ear. "Yes? This is Robert Langdon."
"Signore,"
the woman said in tentative, accented English.
"I am Eugenia Antonucci, the secretary of Ignazio Busoni. You and I, we meet yesterday night when you arrive his office."
Langdon recalled nothing. "Yes?"
"I'm very sorry to say you this, but Ignazio, he died of heart attack yesterday night."
Langdon's grip tightened on the phone.
"Ignazio Busoni is dead?"
The woman was weeping now, her voice full of sadness.
"Ignazio, call me before he die. He leave me a message and tell me to be sure you hear it. I will play it for you."
Langdon heard some rustling, and moments later, a faint, breathless recording of the voice of Ignazio Busoni reached his ears.
"Eugenia,"
the man panted, clearly in pain.
"Please, be sure Robert Langdon hears this message. I'm in trouble. I don't think I'll make it back to the office."
Ignazio groaned, and there was a long silence. When he began speaking again, his voice was weaker.
"Robert, I hope you escaped. They're still after me, and I'm not well. I'm trying to reach a doctor, but..."
There was another long pause, as if Il Duomino were mustering his last bit of energy, and then...
"Robert, listen carefully. What you seek is safely hidden. The gates are open to you, but you must hurry. Paradise 25.
He paused a long moment, and then whispered,
"Godspeed."
Then the message ended. Langdon's heart raced, and he knew he had just witnessed the final words of a dying man. That these words had been directed at him did nothing to relieve his anxiety.
Paradise 25? The gates are open to me?
Langdon considered it.
What gates does he mean?
The only thing that made any sense at all was that Ignazio had said that the mask was safely hidden. Eugenia came back on the line.
"Professor, do you understand this?"
"Some of it, yes."
"Is there something I can do?"
Langdon considered this question a long moment. "Make sure nobody else hears this message."
"Even the police? A detective arrives soon to take my statement."
Langdon stiffened. He looked at the guard who was aiming a gun at him. Quickly, Langdon turned toward the window and lowered his voice, hurriedly whispering,
"Eugenia, this will sound strange, but for Ignazio's sake, I need you to delete that message and do not mention to the police that you spoke to me. Is that clear? The situation is very complicated and..."
Langdon felt a gun barrel press into his side and turned to see the armed guard inches away, holding out his free hand and demanding Marta's phone. On the line there was a long pause, and Eugenia finally said,
"Mr. Langdon, my boss trusted you, so I will too."
Then she was gone. Langdon handed the phone back to the guard. "Ignazio Busoni is dead," he said to Sienna. "He died of a heart attack last night after leaving this museum." Langdon paused. "The mask is safe. Ignazio hid it before he died. And I think he left me a clue about where to find it.
Paradise 25.
Hope flashed in Sienna's eyes, but when Langdon turned back to Marta, she looked skeptical. "Marta," Langdon said, "I can retrieve Dante's mask for you, but you'll need to let us go immediately." Marta laughed out loud.
"I will do no such thing. You're the one who stole the mask. The police are arriving." "Signora Alvarez,"
Sienna interrupted loudly.
Mi dispiace, ma non abbiamo detto la verità.
Langdon did a double take. What is Sienna doing? He had understood her words. Mrs. Alvarez, I'm sorry, but we have not been honest with you. Marta looked equally startled by Sienna's words, although much of her shock seemed to be over the fact that Sienna was suddenly speaking fluent, unaccented Italian.
Innanzitutto, non sono la sorella di Robert Langdon,
Sienna declared in an apologetic tone. First off, I am not Robert Langdon's sister. Chapter 44. Marta Alvarez took an unsteady step backward and folded her arms, studying the young blonde woman before her.
Mi dispiace,
Sienna continued, still speaking fluent Italian.
L'abbiamo mentito su molte cose.
We have lied to you about many things. The guard looked as perplexed as Marta, although he held his position. Sienna spoke rapidly now, still in Italian, telling Marta that she worked at a Florence hospital where Langdon had arrived the previous night with a bullet wound to the head. She explained that Langdon recalled nothing of the events that had brought him there, and that he was as surprised by the security video as Marta had been.
Show her your wound,
Sienna ordered Langdon. When Marta saw the stitches beneath Langdon's matted hair, she sat down on the windowsill and held her face in her hands for several seconds. In the past 10 minutes, Marta had learned not only that the Dante death mask had been stolen during her watch, but that the two thieves had been a respected American professor and her trusted Florentine colleague, who was now dead. Furthermore, the young Sienna Brooks, whom Marta had imagined to be the wide-eyed American sister of Robert Langdon, turned out to be a doctor, admitting to a lie, and doing so in fluent Italian. Marta, Langdon said, his voice deep and understanding, I know it must be hard to believe, but I truly don't remember last night at all. I have no idea why Ignazio and I took the mask. Marta sensed from his eyes that he was telling the truth. I'll return the mask to you, Langdon said. You have my word, but I can't retrieve it unless you let us go. The situation is complicated. You need to let us go right away. Despite wanting the priceless mask returned, Marta had no intention of letting anyone go.
Where are the police?
She looked down at the lone police car in the Piazza della Signoria. It seemed strange that the officers had not yet reached the museum. Marta also heard a strange buzzing noise in the distance. It sounded like someone was using a power saw. And it was getting louder.
What is that?
Langdon's tone was beseeching now. Marta, you know Ignazio. He would never have removed the mask without a good reason. There's a bigger picture here. The owner of the mask, Bertrand Zobrist, was a very confused man. We think he may be involved in something terrible. I don't have time to explain it all, but I'm begging you to trust us. Marta could only stare. None of this seemed to make any sense at all.
Mrs. Alvarez, Sienna said, fixing Marta with a stony look. If you care about your future and that of your baby, then you need to let us leave right now.
Marta folded her hands protectively across her abdomen, not at all pleased by the veiled threat to her unborn child. The high-pitched buzz outside was definitely getting louder, and when Marta peered out the window, she couldn't see the source of the noise. But she did see something else. The guard saw it too, his eyes widening. Down in the Piazza della Signoria, the crowds had parted to make way for a long line of police cars that were arriving without sirens, led by 2 black vans, which now skidded to a stop outside the palace doors. Soldiers in black uniforms jumped out, carrying large guns, and ran into the palace. Marta felt a surge of fear.
Who the hell is that?
The security guard looked equally alarmed. The high-pitched buzzing sound grew suddenly piercing, and Marta withdrew in distress as she glimpsed a small helicopter rising into view just outside the window. The machine hovered no more than 10 yards away, almost as if it were staring in at the people in the room. It was a small craft, maybe a yard long, with a long black cylinder mounted on the front. The cylinder was pointed directly at them.
It's going to shoot, Sienna shouted. Sta per sparare.
Everybody down.
Tutti a terra.
She dropped to her knees beneath the windowsill, and Marta went cold with terror as she instinctively followed suit. The guard dropped down, too, reflexively aiming his gun at the little machine. From Marta's awkward crouch below the windowsill, she could see that Langdon was still standing, staring at Sienna with an odd look, clearly not believing there was any danger. Sienna was on the ground for only an instant before she bounded back up, grabbed Langdon by the wrist, and began pulling him in the direction of the hallway. An instant later, they were fleeing together toward the main entrance of the building. The guard spun on his knees and crouched like a sniper, raising his weapon down the hallway in the direction of the departing duo.
Non spare, Marta ordered him. Non possono scappare.
Don't shoot. They can't possibly escape. Langdon and Sienna disappeared around a corner, and Marta knew it would be only a matter of seconds before the duo collided with the authorities coming in the other way.
Faster, Sienna urged,
rushing with Langdon back the way they'd come in. She was hoping they could make it to the main entrance before running into the police head-on, but she now realized the chances of this were close to zero. Langdon apparently had similar doubts. Without warning, he skidded to a full stop in a wide intersection of hallways. We'll never make it out this way.
Come on,
Sienna motioned urgently for him to follow.
Robert, we can't just stand here.
Langdon seemed distracted, gazing to his left, down a short corridor that appeared to dead-end in a small, dimly lit chamber. The walls of the room were covered with antique maps, and at the center of the room stood a massive iron globe. Langdon eyed the huge metal sphere and began nodding slowly, and then more vigorously.
This way,
Langdon declared, dashing off toward the iron globe.
Robert!
Sienna followed against her better judgment. The corridor clearly led deeper into the museum, away from the exit.
Robert!
She gasped, finally catching up to him.
Where are you taking us?
Through Armenia, he replied.
What?
Armenia, Langdon repeated, his eyes dead ahead. Trust me. One story below, hidden among frightened tourists on the balcony of the Hall of the 500, Vyantha kept her head down as Bruder's SRS team thundered past her into the museum. Downstairs, the sound of slamming doors resonated through the hall as police sealed the area. If Langdon were indeed here, he was trapped. Unfortunately, Vyantha was too. Chapter 45. With its warm oak wainscoting and coffered wooden ceilings, the Hall of Geographical Maps feels a world away from the stark stone and plaster interior of the Palazzo Vecchio. Originally the building's cloakroom, this grand space contains dozens of closets and cabinets once used to store the portable assets of the Grand Duke. On this day, the walls were adorned with maps, 53 illuminations hand-painted on leather, depicting the world as it was known in the 1550s. The hall's dramatic collection of cartography is dominated by the presence of a massive globe that stands in the center of the room. Known as the Mappa Mundi, the 6-foot-tall sphere had been the largest rotating globe of its era and was said to spin almost effortlessly with just the touch of a finger. Today, the globe serves as more of a final stop for tourists who have threaded their way through the long succession of gallery rooms and reached a dead end, where they circle the globe and depart the way they came. Langdon and Sienna arrived breathless in the Hall of Maps. Before them, the Mappa Mundi rose majestically, but Langdon didn't even glance at it, his eyes moving instead to the outer walls of the room.
We need to find Armenia, Langdon said. The map of Armenia.
Clearly nonplussed by his request, Sienna hurried off to the room's right-hand wall in search of a map of Armenia. Langdon immediately began a similar search along the left-hand wall, tracing his way around the perimeter of the room.
Arabia, Spain, Greece.
Each country was portrayed in remarkable detail, considering that the drawings had been made more than 500 years ago, at a time when much of the world had yet to be mapped or explored.
Where is Armenia?
Compared to his usually vivid eidetic memories, Langdon's recollections of his secret passages tour here several years ago felt cloudy, due in no small part to the second glass of Gaia Nebbiolo he'd enjoyed with lunch prior to the tour. Fittingly, the word Nebbiolo meant little fog. Even so, Langdon now distinctly recalled being shown a single map in this room, Armenia, a map that possessed a unique property.
I know it's in here, Langdon thought,
continuing to scan the seemingly endless line of maps.
Armenia, Sienna announced. Over here.
Langdon spun toward where she was standing in the deep right-hand corner of the room. He rushed over, and Sienna pointed to the map of Armenia with an expression that seemed to say, "We found Armenia, so what?" Langdon knew they didn't have time for explanations. Instead, he simply reached out, grabbed the map's massive wooden frame, and heaved it toward him. The entire map swung into the room, along with a large section of the wall and wainscoting, revealing a hidden passageway.
All right, then, Sienna said, sounding impressed. Armenia it is.
Without hesitation, Sienna hurried through the opening, moving fearlessly into the dim space beyond. Langdon followed her and quickly pulled the wall closed behind them. Despite his foggy recollections of the secret passage's tour, Langdon recalled this passageway clearly. He and Sienna had just passed, as it were, through the looking glass into the Palazzo Invisibile, the clandestine world that existed behind the walls of the Palazzo Vecchio, a secret domain that had been accessible solely to the then-reigning duke and those closest to him. Langdon paused a moment inside the doorway and took in their new surroundings. A pale stone hallway lit only by faint natural light that filtered through a series of leaded windows. The passageway descended 50 yards or so to a wooden door. He turned now to his left, where a narrow ascending staircase was blocked by a chain swag. A sign above the stairs warned, "Uscita vietata." Langdon headed for the stairs.
"No," Sienna warned. "It says no exit."
"Thanks," Langdon said with a wry smile. "I can read the Italian." He unhooked the chain swag, carried it back to the secret door, and quickly used it to immobilize the rotating wall, threading the chain through the door handle and around a nearby fixture so the door could not be pulled open from the other side.
"Oh," Sienna said sheepishly. "Good thinking."
"It won't keep them out for long," Langdon said, "but we won't need much time. Follow me." When the map of Armenia finally crashed open, Agent Bruder and his men streamed down the narrow corridor in pursuit, heading for the wooden door at the far end. When they burst through, Bruder felt a blast of cold air hit him head-on and was momentarily blinded by bright sunlight. He had arrived on an exterior walkway which threaded along the rooftop of the palazzo. His eye traced the path, which led directly to another door some 50 yards away, and re-entered the building. Bruder glanced to the left of the walkway, where the high, vaulted roof of the Hall of the 500 rose like a mountain.
Impossible to traverse.
Bruder turned now to his right, where the walkway was bordered by a sheer cliff that plummeted down into a deep light well.
Instant death.
His eyes refocused straight ahead.
This way!
Bruder and his men dashed along the walkway toward the second door, while the surveillance drone circled like a vulture overhead. When Bruder and his men burst through the doorway, they all slid to an abrupt stop, nearly piling up on one another. They were standing in a tiny stone chamber that had no exit other than the door through which they had just come. A lone wooden desk stood against the wall. Overhead, the grotesque figures depicted in the chamber's ceiling frescoes seemed to stare down at them mockingly. It was a dead end. One of Bruder's men hurried over and scanned the informational placard on the wall.
"Hold on," he said. "This says there's a fenestra in here. Some kind of secret window?"
Bruder looked around but saw no secret window. He marched over and read the placard himself. Apparently, this space had once been the private study of Duchess Bianca Capello and included the secret window, una finestra segreta, through which Bianca could covertly watch her husband deliver speeches down below in the Hall of the 500. Bruder's eyes searched the room again, now locating a small lattice-covered opening discreetly hidden in the side wall.
Did they escape through there?
He stalked over and examined the opening, which appeared to be too small for someone of Langdon's size to get through. Bruder pressed his face to the grid and peered through, confirming for certain that nobody had escaped this way. On the other side of the lattice was a sheer drop, straight down several stories to the floor of the Hall of the 500.
So where the hell did they go?
As Bruder turned back into the tiny stone chamber, he felt all of the day's frustration mounting within him.
In a rare moment of unrestrained emotion, Agent Bruder threw back his head and let out a bellow of rage. The noise was deafening in the tiny space. Far below, in the hall of the 500, tourists and police officers all spun and stared up at the latticed opening high on the wall. From the sounds of things, the Duchess's secret study was now being used to cage a wild animal. Sienna Brooks and Robert Langdon stood in total darkness. Minutes earlier, Sienna had watched Langdon cleverly use the chain to seal the rotating map of Armenia, then turn and flee. To her surprise, however, instead of heading down the corridor, Langdon had gone up the steep staircase that had been marked Ushita Vietata.
"Robert," she whispered in confusion, "the sign said no exit. And besides, I thought we wanted to go down."
"We do," Langdon said, glancing over his shoulder. "But sometimes you need to go up, to go down." He gave her an encouraging wink. "Remember Satan's navel?"
"What is he talking about?"
Sienna bounded after him, feeling lost. "Did you ever read Inferno?" Langdon asked.
"Yes, but I think I was 7.
An instant later, it dawned on her.
"Oh, Satan's navel," she said. "Now I remember."
It had taken a moment, but Sienna now realized that Langdon was referring to the finale of Dante's Inferno. In these cantos, in order to escape hell, Dante has to climb down the hairy stomach of the massive Satan, and when he reaches Satan's navel, the alleged center of the Earth's gravity suddenly switches directions, and Dante, in order to continue climbing down to purgatory, suddenly has to start climbing up. Sienna remembered little of the Inferno other than her disappointment in witnessing the absurd actions of gravity at the center of the Earth. Apparently, Dante's genius did not include a grasp of the physics of vector forces. They reached the top of the stairs, and Langdon opened the lone door they found there. On it was written, "Sala dei Modelli di Architettura." Langdon ushered her inside, closing and bolting the door behind them. The room was small and plain, containing a series of cases that displayed wooden models of Vasari's architectural designs for the interior of the palazzo. Sienna barely noticed the models. She did, however, notice that the room had no doors, no windows, and, as advertised, no exit.
"In the mid-1300s, Langdon whispered, "the Duke of Athens assumed power in the palace and built this secret escape route in case he was attacked. It's called the Duke of Athens Stairway, and it descends to a tiny escape hatch on a side street. If we can get there, nobody will see us exit." He pointed to one of the models. "Look, see it there on the side?"
"He brought me up here to show me models?"
Sienna shot an anxious glance at the miniature and saw the secret staircase descending all the way from the top of the palace down to street level, stealthily hidden between the inner and outer walls of the building.
"I can see the stairs, Robert," Sienna said testily, "but they are on the complete opposite side of the palace. We'll never get over there."
"A little faith," he said with a lopsided grin. A sudden crash emanating from downstairs told them that the map of Armenia had just been breached. They stood stone still as they listened to the footfalls of soldiers departing down the corridor, none of them ever thinking that their quarry would climb higher still, especially up a tiny staircase marked no exit. When the sounds below had subsided, Langdon strode with confidence across the exhibit room, snaking through the displays, heading directly for what looked like a large cupboard in the far wall. The cupboard was about 1 yard square and positioned 3 feet off the floor. Without hesitation, Langdon grabbed the handle and heaved open the door. Sienna recoiled with surprise. The space within appeared to be a cavernous void, as if the cupboard door were a portal into another world. Beyond was only blackness.
"Follow me," Langdon said.
He grabbed a lone flashlight that was hanging on the wall beside the opening. Then, with surprising agility and strength, the professor hoisted himself up through the opening and disappeared into the rabbit hole. Chapter 46
La Sofita, Langdon thought. The most dramatic attic on Earth.
The air inside the void smelled musty and ancient, as if centuries of plaster dust had now become so fine and light that it refused to settle, and instead hung suspended in the atmosphere. The vast space creaked and groaned, giving Langdon the sense that he had just climbed into the belly of a living beast. Once he had found solid footing on a broad horizontal truss cord, he raised his flashlight, letting the beam pierce the darkness. Spreading out before him was a seemingly endless tunnel, crisscrossed by a wooden web of triangles and rectangles formed by the intersections of posts, beams, cords, and other structural elements that made up the invisible skeleton of the Hall of the 500. This enormous attic space was one Langdon had viewed during his Nebbiolo-fogged secret passages tour a few years ago. The cupboard-like viewing window had been cut in the wall of the architectural model room so visitors could inspect the models of the trusswork and then peer through the opening with a flashlight and see the real thing. Now that Langdon was actually inside the garret, he was surprised by how much the truss architecture resembled that of an old New England barn. Traditional king post and strut assembly with Jupiter's arrow point connections. Sienna had also climbed through the opening and now steadied herself on the beam beside him, looking disoriented. Langdon swung the flashlight back and forth to show her the unusual landscape. From this end, the view down the length of the garret was like peering through a long line of isosceles triangles that telescoped into the distance, extending out toward some distant vanishing point. Beneath their feet, the garret had no floorboards, and its horizontal supporting beams were entirely exposed, resembling a series of massive railroad ties. Langdon pointed straight down the long shaft, speaking in hushed tones.
"This space is directly over the Hall of the 500. If we can get to the other end, I know how to reach the Duke of Athens' stairway."
Sienna cast a skeptical eye into the labyrinth of beams and supports that stretched before them. The only apparent way to advance through the garret would be to jump between the struts like kids on a train track. The struts were large, each consisting of numerous beams strapped together with wide iron clasps into a single powerful sheaf, plenty large enough to balance on. The challenge, however, was that the separation between the struts was much too far to leap across safely.
"I can't possibly jump between those beams,"
Sienna whispered.
Langdon doubted he could either, and falling would be certain death.
He aimed the flashlight down through the open space between the struts. 8 feet below them, suspended by iron rods, hung a dusty horizontal expanse, a floor of sorts, which extended as far as they could see. Despite its appearance of solidity, Langdon knew the floor consisted primarily of stretched fabric covered in dust. This was the back side of the Hall of the 500's suspended ceiling, a sprawling expanse of wooden lacunars that framed 39 Vasari canvases, all mounted horizontally in a kind of patchwork quilt configuration. Sienna pointed down to the dusty expanse beneath them.
"Can we climb down there and walk across?"
"Not unless you want to fall through a Vasari canvas into the Hall of the 500.
Actually, there's a better way," Langdon said calmly, not wanting to frighten her. He began moving down the strut toward the central backbone of the garret. On his previous visit, in addition to peering through the viewing window in the room of architectural models, Langdon had explored the garret on foot, entering through a doorway at the other end of the attic. If his wine-impaired memory served him, a sturdy boardwalk ran along the central spine of the garret, providing tourists access to a large viewing deck in the center of the space. However, when Langdon arrived at the center of the strut, he found a boardwalk that in no way resembled the one he recalled from his tour.
"How much Nebbiolo did I drink that day?"
Rather than a sturdy, tourist-worthy structure, he was looking at a hodgepodge of loose planks that had been laid perpendicularly across the beams to create a rudimentary catwalk, more of a tightrope than a bridge. Apparently, the sturdy tourist walkway that originated at the other end extended only as far as the central viewing platform. From there, the tourists evidently retraced their steps. This jerry-rigged balance beam that Langdon and Sienna now faced was most likely installed so engineers could service the remaining attic space at this end.
"Looks like we're walking the plank," Langdon said,
eyeing the narrow boards with uncertainty. Sienna shrugged, unfazed.
No worse than Venice in flood season.
Langdon realized she had a point. On his most recent research trip to Venice, St. Mark's Square had been under a foot of water, and he had walked from the Hotel Danieli to the Basilica on wooden planks propped between cinder blocks and inverted buckets. Of course, the prospect of possibly getting one's loafers wet was a far cry from that of plunging through a Renaissance masterpiece to one's death. Pushing the thought from his mind, Langdon stepped out onto the narrow board with a feigned self-assurance that he hoped would calm any worries Sienna might secretly be harboring. Nonetheless, despite his confident exterior, his heart was pounding as he moved across the first plank. As he neared the middle, the plank bowed beneath his weight, creaking ominously. He pressed on, faster now, finally reaching the other side and the relative safety of the second strut. Exhaling, Langdon turned to shine the light for Sienna, and also offer any coaxing words she might need. She apparently needed none. As soon as his beam illuminated the plank, she was skimming along its length with remarkable dexterity. The board barely bent beneath her slender body, and within seconds she had joined him on the other side. Encouraged, Langdon turned back and headed out across the next plank. Sienna waited until he had crossed and could turn around and shine the light for her, and then she followed, staying right with him. Settling into a steady rhythm, they pressed on, two figures moving one after the other by the light of a single flashlight. From somewhere beneath them, the sound of police walkie-talkies crackled up through the thin ceiling. Langdon permitted himself a faint smile. We're hovering above the Hall of the 500, weightless and invisible.
So, Robert, Sienna whispered, you said Ignazio told you where to find the mask?
He did, but in a kind of code.
Langdon quickly explained that Ignazio had apparently not wanted to blurt out the mask's location on the answering machine, and so he had shared the information in a more cryptic manner.
He referenced Paradise, which I assume is an allusion to the final section of the Divine Comedy. His exact words were Paradise 25. She glanced up.
He must mean Canto 25.
I agree, Langdon said.
A canto was the rough equivalent of a chapter, the word hearkening back to the oral tradition of singing epic poems. The Divine Comedy contained precisely 100 cantos in all, divided into three sections. Inferno, 1 to 34, Purgatorio, 1 to 33, Paradiso, 1 to 33.
Paradise 25, Langdon thought,
wishing his eidetic memory were strong enough to recall the entire text. Not even close. We need to find a copy of the text. There's more, Langdon continued. The last thing Ignazio said to me was, "The gates are open to you, but you must hurry." He paused, glancing back at Sienna. Canto 25 probably makes reference to a specific location here in Florence. Apparently, some place with gates. Sienna frowned.
But this city probably has dozens of gates.
Yes, which is why we need to read Canto 25 of Paradise. He gave her a hopeful smile. You don't, by any chance, know the entire Divine Comedy by heart, do you? She gave him a dumb look.
14,000 lines of archaic Italian that I read as a kid?
She shook her head.
You're the one with the freakish memory, Professor. I'm just a doctor.
As they pressed on, Langdon found it sad somehow that Sienna, even after all they'd been through together, apparently still preferred to withhold the truth about her exceptional intellect. She's just a doctor? Langdon had to chuckle. Most humble doctor on earth, he thought, recalling the clippings he'd read about her special skills. Skills that, unfortunately but not surprisingly, did not include total recall of one of history's longest epic poems. In silence, they continued on, crossing several more beams. Finally, up ahead, Langdon saw a heartening shape in the darkness.
The viewing platform.
The precarious planking on which they were walking led directly to a much sturdier structure with guardrails. If they climbed onto the platform, they could continue on along the walkway until they exited the garret through a doorway, which, as Langdon recalled, was very close to the Duke of Athens' stairway. As they neared the platform, Langdon glanced down at the ceiling suspended 8 feet below. So far, all the lunettes beneath them had been similar. The upcoming lunette, however, was massive, far larger than the others. The apotheosis of Cosimo I, Langdon mused. This vast, circular lunette was Vasari's most precious painting, the central lunette in the entire hall of the 500. Langdon often showed slides of this work to his students, pointing out its similarities to the apotheosis of Washington in the U.S. Capitol, a humble reminder that fledgling America had adopted far more from Italy than merely the concept of a republic. Today, however, Langdon was more interested in hurrying past the apotheosis than in studying it. As he hastened his pace, he turned his head ever so slightly to whisper back to Sienna that they were nearly there. As he did so, his right foot missed the center of the plank and his borrowed loafer landed half off the edge. His ankle rolled and Langdon lurched forward, half stumbling, half running, trying to make a quick stutter step to regain his balance, but it was too late. His knees hit the plank hard and his hands strained desperately forward, trying to reach the crossing strut. The flashlight went clattering into the dark space beneath them, landing on the canvas, which caught it like a net. Langdon's legs pumped, barely propelling him to safety on the next strut as the plank fell away beneath him, landing with a crash 8 feet below on the wooden lacuna surrounding the canvas of Vasari's apotheosis. The sound echoed through the garret. Horrified, Langdon scrambled to his feet and turned back toward Sienna. In the dim glow of the abandoned flashlight which lay on the canvas below, Langdon could see that Sienna was standing on the strut behind him, now trapped, with no way across. Her eyes conveyed what Langdon already knew. The noise of the falling plank had almost certainly given them away. Bayantha's eyes bolted upward to the ornate ceiling. "Rats in the attic?" the man with the camcorder joked nervously as the sound reverberated down. "Big rats," Bayantha thought, gazing up at the circular painting in the center of the hall's ceiling. A small cloud of dust was now filtering down from between the lacunas, and Bayantha could swear she saw a slight bulge in the canvas, almost as if someone were pushing on it from the other side. "Maybe one of the officers dropped his gun off the viewing platform," the man said, eyeing the lump in the painting. "What do you think they're looking for? All this activity is very exciting."
"A viewing platform?" Bayantha demanded. "People can actually go up there?"
"Sure." He motioned to the museum entrance. "Just inside that door is a door that leads up to a catwalk in the attic. You can see Vasari's trusswork. It's incredible." Bruder's voice suddenly echoed again across the hall of the 500.
"So where the hell did they go?"
His words, like his anguished yell a little earlier, had emanated from behind a lattice grate positioned high on the wall to Vianta's left. Bruder was apparently in a room behind the grate, a full story beneath the room's ornate ceiling. Vianta's eyes climbed again to the bulge in the canvas overhead.
"Rats in the attic," she thought, "trying to find a way out."
She thanked the man with the camcorder and drifted quickly toward the museum entrance. The door was closed, but with all the officers running in and out, she suspected that it was unlocked. Sure enough, her instincts were correct.